I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today's Wednesday, May 2nd, 2018, and the time is 9:34. Members present today are Co-Chairs Hoffman, myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Stevens, Senator Olson, and Senator Machicki. Good morning, everybody. Today's agenda, we're going to continue this morning with the SB 193 Medicaid assistance work requirement. And anything else to come before the committee before we start with SB 193? Seeing none. Today's agenda, we previously took action. We heard on 4-12-2018, we took the bill, and on 5-1-2018, we heard the bill. We did take public testimony. We did review fiscal notes, and we're going to ask Senator Kelly's staff to Ms. Heather Carpenter, please come up, and we'll do a quick review on the bill. And then in the room, we're going to have for questions Department of Health and Social Services. We got the Department of Labor as well represented in the back of the room there this morning. And Ms. O'Brien is also with us this morning. Good morning, everyone. Ms. Carpenter.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. Just a quick recap, Senate Bill 193 would ask the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for an 1115 waiver to take advantage of a new CMS, so the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid policy that would allow work requirements to be in work requirements to happen on the able-bodied Medicaid population. So Senate Bill 193 asks the department to apply for that waiver and lays out several exemptions that would be included in the waiver for that population, including, so it would ask that population to work for 20 hours a week or volunteer or complete in subsistence activities, pregnant women, children, the elderly, the disabled, certain caregivers would all be exempted. And I can walk through other reminders if the committee needs it.
I think the committee appears to be fine. Thank you. All right. In the room, we had some discussion that ended yesterday. We were talking centered around a lot around the 10% or the 22,500 participants in the target population. We had some conversation going around that. Hess is in the room. If committee members have questions this morning of Ms. O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner, and or the Department of Labor, we could just have both of them come to the table if we want to get into that conversation right now. This will of the committee. Senator Machicki.
Mr. Chairman, it'd be nice to have the Department of Labor up this morning. I think I don't have any questions for Hess this morning.
It's all right. With the committee, I'd like to bring them both up because just so they're here, because I can see that the conversation might drift and do some cross-pollinization. So Department of Labor, Mr. Harvey, Dan Robinson, you guys want to come up. And Ms. O'Brien, you could just, if you could come up another one row closer in case we get into that cross-pollinization conversation.
At ease, Mr. Chairman.
We're at ease. Back on the record, Senator Machicki.
So one of the things that we're thinking about in this bill is asking the Department of Labor to help us identify some gaps in employment throughout Alaska, perhaps gaps in training. It looks like we perpetually accepted non-working healthy Alaskans for the long term, and some of us would like to change that trend to help find opportunities for those individuals to excel and just reach their full potential, I guess. How would you see the Department of Labor working with Health and Social Services on assisting a work program for Medicaid recipients and ultimately success, financial independence, and less dependence on the government for those families?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Harvey. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Division of Employment and Training Services, and I oversee the job centers in the state. Through the chair, Senator Michicki, that is an ongoing question. It's one that we currently work with DPA on right now. There's the TANF Work Services population, or that program, that DPA partners very well with the job centers on. Through our job centers in the state, we provide self-service access to online resources or in-person resources at our 14 sites. We provide staff-assisted self-help. We provide staff-assisted services, case management, and enrollment in some federal and state job training programs if eligibility and suitability is met for work readiness. And so that's an ongoing connection that we have right now with that program, and I could see that occurring with the program such as is being put forth right now.
Senator Michicki, follow up.
So, in just part of this discussion, I believe our unemployment rate went up 0.1%, and the depths of the recession here, which seems to be improving. Yet, when we list our jobs, and I've seen it on several slides, less than half of Alaskans are working. We seem to be the lowest per capita employed, and of course, we always, due to the seasonal nature of our employment opportunities, we most often have the highest unemployment rate in the U.S. But why do we list being at 7.1% now? 7.3%. So we must have been around 7.2 when we got into this dip. But why do we list that when less than half of us are actually working? How do we engage those that are no longer on the rolls as being unemployed and help them to reach their full potential?
Senator Michicki, Dan Robinson, Research Chief at the Department of Labor. Couple of parts of that question. The last part I'm going to save for James. How do we help them? Because it's job service kind of stuff, and that's part of what Department of Labor does. It's not what we do with the data. Answering some questions related to the data, we do have the highest unemployment rate in the country, 7.3%, comfortably the highest. The next highest state is New Mexico, 5.6. But we don't have a very high unemployment rate relative to our history. Our 10-year average is 7.2%. The way it's calculated, it's calculated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics to be very smooth. So be careful not to read too much into the slow movement of that rate. It's a model, and it never moves more than 1/10 of a percentage point in its current model formulation. So it's slow to reflect economic distress. What I quite often tell people is clearly the without question in my mind, the better macro indicator of how our economy is doing is jobs. What are we adding jobs? Or are we losing jobs? We continue to lose jobs, not by a large margin, but we do still continue to lose jobs. Our most recent month, March, has us down 2,500, something like that, minus 0.8%. So we are still, by our definition, in a recession. We're still losing jobs. Conceptually, and this was another question that I know was yesterday, that to be counted as unemployed, you have to be actively seeking work. And that's a tricky thing to discern sometimes, right? So what I quite often encourage people to look at that you don't hear a lot about is employment to population ratio. And Senator Michicki, you alluded to that. What percentage of our working age population is working? Alaska's in 2017 was 62%. And a key point there is it's civilian, non-institutional population. So that's not military, and that's not prisoners. So 62% of our civilian, non-institutional population worked in 2017. That's about 20th highest among states. North Dakota's highest at 70%. You start to get in states with older populations, and it's lower. But we don't fare particularly poorly as a state. Parts of rural Alaska, on the other hand, are very, very low employment-to-population ratios. Back to the unemployment rate, parts of rural Alaska have among the highest unemployment rates in the nation. Kushovac, Yukon-Koyukuk, Northwest Arctic, Bethel, routinely among the top 10 counties in the nation for unemployment rates. So it's the statewide number's one thing. The Alaska's got different issues in parts of the state is another. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Question, follow-up, Senator Machicki?
Just one brief follow-up. So what can we do as a team? Because I think this is bigger than Medicaid, work requirements for Medicaid. This is bigger than that. And that, for those that are probably dreading having to deal with this from the Medicaid folks, just because it's different and it's, it's more work, face it, right? It's going to be more work. It's difficult to say what the return is as far as Medicaid reductions go. Does the department have a team assembled, and how can we assist that team on creating opportunities for those parts of the state? I actually think it's a problem all over the state. And, of course, you're saying that we have relatively healthy statistics in parts of Alaska, and parts of Alaska we don't. How can we help assist you in creating opportunities? What tools do you need? Because it is bigger. It's about leaving an example for the next generation. It's about all of the other social programs that are hit. It's about some of the social ills that occur when folks are my grandmother used to call it idle hands, right? What can we do to support you on creating opportunities in Alaska for bringing that unemployment rate down and bringing some of those folks that are not even counted anymore back into, I always like to say, reaching their full potential, because there is enormous talent throughout our state that is not currently employed, and we just don't even know what we're missing on what their potential may be.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, I'll answer the first part of that question, and then I think it's over to James again. Our shop produces the data, and one thing you can do is use the data. Ask us to do more. I hope we do a lot that's helpful to understand. We've written, for example, why Alaska's unemployment rate tends to be 2 or 3 percentage points higher than the nation. Seasonality is part of it. Something called structural unemployment is a part of it. So that's not having the workers with the skills that the economy is producing in your state. Some of that's geographic. We've got a tremendous number of jobs in parts of the state where we have to import workers. We've got other parts of the state where there are workers without jobs. So we've got some interesting challenges along those lines. But for my team, I guess let us help you. Ask us if there are specific questions, data questions, and we'll do our best to answer them, the other side.
Thank you.
Could we hear from James? I'm very very interested in hearing.
That would be fine, and we have Senators Von Imhoff and Senator Stevens in the queue. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. I would echo what Mr. Robinson said about the data. Using the data is important. We do need to realize in some of these data points that we're gathering that they're human in nature to begin with. And so looking at populations such as this, there are the data points within the population, and that is what barriers may these people present them as individuals or as a total. And at this point in time, we don't know what those barriers may or may not be. The department, or specifically the job centers, is very adept at handling barriers to employment in terms of applying for jobs, some of that skill set, maybe the training as a barrier to employment. There may be other barriers present that we're seeing throughout the state with some other emergent issues that the job centers may not be the most adept at handling and may need to refer or partner with other agencies, as we do now, to address some of those barriers to employment. As far as the outreach, getting folks into employment, I think our state's 14 current job centers do a wonderful job of outreaching to the general public to bring awareness to job opportunities as they're presenting themselves and in preparation for their presentation. Right now, we're coming into one of the high seasonal times of the year, and several of our offices are going nonstop with recruitment sessions, and one industry in particular right now is seafood. And I can tell you at our Anchorage Midtown Job Center and some of our other local sites, it is standing room only. And so we're really trying to get the word out about employment opportunities, and not to forget that we serve both the job seekers of the state, but also the employer. We need to fulfill their needs as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Senator Von Imhoff is next, and Senator Stevens, followed by Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you made a comment about working with existing stakeholders in Alaska to help, and I wanted to take that thread and go with it a little bit. I do understand, I'm more familiar with Anchorage based, where I represent. So there's many organizations: United Way, the Forker Group, the Career Academy, Union Trade Groups, UAA adjunct classes, the YWCA, all of these provide job training classes, AvTech. I have CITC, Cook Inlet Tribal Corporation. They have, GED preparation, employment supportive services, employment training and services, a whole program. And I've actually visited and walked the floor. It's pretty spectacular. We also have, even in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, right here, I can see we had loan programs, business assistance center, intrastate crowdfunding, and work readiness programs, so even within the state right there. So one of the things is we need to pair existing organizations with the Department of Labor, which it sounds like you're doing, and Health and Social Services to fully engage and leverage the people and assets that we have right now. And I think... when we have the sticker shock of a 49-person ask for the fiscal note, I guess what I ask is, has that been fully incorporated with leveraging existing assets and organizations and people and programs and classes and so forth? It takes a lot of work. Someone's got to coordinate it all. Someone's got to meet with everybody. It's hard, but it's... you fully use all the brain power and all of the experience and institutional knowledge that we have, and these need to be utilized, and we can better help this program. So, and I do have, Mr. Chairman, so you know, we have someone signed up to invited testimony who is there, who can talk more about that when you're ready to have that person. Thank you.
Senator Stevens, thank you for those comments. Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Robinson, I'm not clear how seasonal folks fit into your data and how that enters the statistical information. You know, historically, in my community, Kodiak, Cordova, all of the coastal communities, you know, it's a there's no reason for anyone to have trouble finding a job. But it is seasonal. And does that you're talking about full-time positions mostly? Can you give some reflection on how seasonal work and I end by saying that we often have to go outside of Alaska to find employees, which makes no sense at all if someone is able to work in our community.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the data's compiled, collected, and compiled and disseminated monthly. So Kodiak, for example, and all the other boroughs and cities areas have a monthly unemployment rate. Kodiak, Aleutians East, Aleutians West, Bristol Bay, Skagway, Denali Borough have really low unemployment rates during the peak seasonal activity seasons. Then they have Skagway and Denali more than anything else as kind of single element economies, tourism. The unemployment rate goes up quite a bit in the winter. Interestingly, a lot of those people aren't counted as unemployed because they're not looking for work because everyone knows there are no jobs when the lodges are closed. Kodiak is kind of interesting because it's big enough that you, more so than other parts of fishing Alaska, provide the workers locally. You have a big enough, unlike Bristol, some of the Aleutians. So the short answer is we compile that data monthly. You can see those big seasonal swings if you're working. Then we tabulate that and produce that data monthly. If you're not working, the unemployment rates attempt to show that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that fits into the annual statistical reports that you do as well.
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you address the downturn that we're in and our population loss? What is the trend? What has the trend been in the last 3 years? And I think it can be directly attributed to the economic conditions in Alaska. How long are people on the unemployment list? Those are the people that are looking for jobs before they decide to move out of state.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, and I heard some of your questions yesterday about a snapshot of the economy, so I just took a quick look at some of the numbers to refresh my memory. We have had 5 years in a row of net migration losses, so that means more people moving out of Alaska than moving to Alaska. That has added up to about 30,000 people. We have not had net population loss over that period because natural increase, births minus deaths, has been 35,000. So we've had only in 2017 did we have actual population loss. But we do have that five-year pattern of more people leaving Alaska than moving to Alaska. And one part about that data that caught my attention is historically we've more people in their 20s clear through mid-40s have moved to Alaska than from Alaska. In recent years, people in their 30s and K-12 age groups, more people are leaving than coming. Those are related, right? 30-year-olds are the parents of the kids. But that's something I think we should pay attention to. If we start losing more 30-year-olds than we're getting, that's prime, that's beginning working age years, and we should pay attention to that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to ask this of, but the goal of the bill seems to be to get government dependence lessened by one way or another. And as you look at trying to break that cycle, it seems to be harder to break out in rural Alaska where opportunities are much less. And I was wondering, of the 22,000 that are there that are affected by this bill, how many actually live in rural Alaska versus, or bush Alaska versus urban Alaska? Where, do you have those numbers? Does anybody have those numbers? I'm assuming Health and Social Services is probably the ones that have.
For the record, this is Shonda O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner for Health and Social Services, and Senator Olson through the chair. I think we could probably get a better breakout for you. I don't have that off the top of my head, though.
That's fine. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if you could, when you get that information, if you could deliver that to the chair's office, Chair McKinnon's office, that would be great, and we'll get that to the committee members. Senator Machicki.
So, When it comes to Mr. Robinson, so I assume the way that you calculate the unemployment rate is based on some sort of federal formula. Is that correct,
Senator Machicki? It's each state has its own model. Mm-hmm. The Bureau of Labor Statistics designs those models. We provide input, but realistically, we receive the model. They're constantly tinkering with them, but the concepts have been consistent since really the 30s. It's not hard to figure out who's working. It's not hard to figure out who's not working. It is hard to figure out whether the ones not working should be counted as unemployed. Think of a voluntary stay-at-home parent, a retiree. There are lots of reasons people don't work that have nothing to do with a lack of availability of jobs.
Just
follow up.
Yeah, it just seems like a very different state when we're at 7.3% and we seem to be calculating on seasonality, yet some of those jobs are earning a very healthy living in the short time they're working. I mean, I don't know how fishermen are calculated and guides and, you know, tourism related. I mean, I think there's a conversion of that data that has to take place to truly understand it.
Well, Senator Machicki, through the chair, our economy challenges the models to do what they're mm-hmm. designed to do. And the best example of that is just the big inflow of workers to seafood processing in Bristol Bay, for example. There are census ratios and survey. There are a handful of imperfect inputs into the model. But and that's one more reason why our unemployment rate is, I discourage people from using it as the best measure of our economic health.
Mr. Chairman, last question is eight. So what this bill is about for me, these questions are related. This, for me, on Medicaid, we're spending almost $12,000 per capita on Medicaid. There's 218,000, nearly a third of our population. High utilization, a high amount of folks that are depending on it. The way that I see this bill is moving from a lifetime of government dependence to a system of helping folks succeed. And I don't think that we spend any less in the grand scheme of things. I think what we have to do as a state is shift toward teaching a man to fish. And I know it's not going to happen overnight, but we're not gaining ground, and I think we do need to all work together to put a system in place. I'd rather spend the same amount in a way that leads toward independence. And obviously you're all focused on the same thing. We just haven't quite gotten there yet. So we're certainly here to support you as you work through a better outcome, I think.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Seeing no other questions from the committee, I believe we have an Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry, I think I need to have a little more understanding. I appreciate what Senator Machicki has said, and I think there are reasons beyond just saving money. So can you quantify or identify those reasons why it's an advantage for folks to work if they can? I mean, it seems to me that it's hard to talk about some of these things, but make you feel better about life, make you feel more involved. I mean, can you quantify any of those things, or not quantify them, but just help list those reasons why folks that are now not working would be advantaged by working?
Senator Stevens, I think much of that is, I think James knows more. I will just mention one recent study we did with Department of Corrections data to identify the effect of getting a job on recidivism. You go into a project like that expecting it to have an enormous effect. Somewhat surprisingly, most of the released prisoners had worked, but if they didn't have a fairly high-paying job, a fairly good job, then it didn't affect their recidivism as much as we would have thought, as much as I thought, right? So there are different levels of employment, and a lot of times we mash data together to get average income or average something else. It's important to look at distribution, and we've done some of that work, but that's one maybe small contribution I'll make to that a job, for some of the reasons you say, there's plentiful research that a job matters psychologically, economically, likelihood of getting benefits, but not just any job. There are lots of people bouncing around. We have 15, 16,000 retail trade workers. We have lots of food servers. There are lots of jobs that, for whatever reason, I mean, they don't produce some of those benefits that you're talking about to the degree that a $30,000, $40,000 a year job does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a very interesting comment. I really appreciate that it's not just any job. It's a job that has meaning, and very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I have some comments, but I'm saving mine for the end. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that I, with Senator Stevens, that I think I made the point that I'd rather spend the same amount. So for me, it's not necessarily about saving money, right? I think we'd spend the same amount on helping to develop those meaningful employment opportunities. There's no doubt that we have to use every tool we can to reduce our spend in It has. I mean, it's utilization is very high. The amount of beneficiaries is very high. Unfortunately, we're because of the healthy that we're having to support, sometimes we're having to pinch back on the programs for the disabled and seniors. So I think we're going to spend the same amount. As I said, I'd rather spend the same amount yet help people reach meaningful employment than a perpetual amount of spend on something that just never gets us there. And I didn't know if that was worthy of clarifying or not, but I don't think we're going to save a lot of money. I just think one way breaks the cycle and one way continues it the way we've been going forever.
Thank you for your comments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Vaughn now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment on your last comment. While a job that is meaningful may in your data collection or the Department of Law Corrections data collection show less recidivism, I hope that the message is not, well, gee, if you get a job that doesn't pay enough or that you don't necessarily like or doesn't give you enough hours, don't take it. I hope that the message is, let's find decent work that can build over time, that you can gain experience, that you can increase in wages and so forth. I just want to make sure that the message is not, well, unless you get your best job with the best amount right off the bat, don't bother. Thank you.
Senator Von Himoff, through the chair. I hope that, and we don't message anything, right? We're value neutral or policy neutral. But we did an article on retail trade workers, where are they 10 years later? And it showed precisely what you're talking about. Whether they were still in retail trade, there were a few doctors 10 years later. So jobs lead to other jobs. I hope we've got lots of data, and I hope we've communicated that very clearly. And even if you stay in retail, again, just to make that point, they were making quite a bit more money 10 years later. So absolutely.
I'd just like to remind our testifiers, please put your name on the record. We have three people at the table, and it's a little hard for Senate records maybe to discern. That was Dan Robinson from Research and Analysis, Department of Labor. Seeing no other questions, we do have an invited guest, Mr. Morgan from Anchorage. And are you there, Mr. Morgan?
Yes, I am. I've been watching.
If you could hang on just a second, we're going to get the volume adjusted. Keep talking, but I would like for you to if you could kind of keep your comments within about five minutes, please, or so, tighten them up, because we have another committee hearing here at 10:30, and we need to be gone. Thank you.
Okay, how's that? Does that sound pretty good?
Perfect.
Okay. I found out about the hearing yesterday in the afternoon when I was cruising 360 and saw the hearing and some of the things that were being said. I have sent my resume to put on the record, but my name's Dave Morgan. Some of you know me, some of you don't. I'm a healthcare economist. I've been in Alaska since 1984. I've worked 15 years for South Central Foundation in reimbursement, 5 years for Providence Hospital, and 6 years out of Sandpoint for Eastern Aleutian Tribes. I was on the healthcare commission 5 years, and I was chairman of the Health and Human Services Commission for Anchorage under Mayor Sullivan. So I'll start off with the assignment that I gave myself last night at 6 o'clock. And I have made contact with some of the people I've worked with when I was advising on their Medicaid program in my home state of Kentucky, where I grew up and went to school. Governor Blevin says hello. And he plans to send some materials up to the committee. Also, Doug Hogan, who's in charge of the Cabinet for Health and Family Services for the state of Alaska. The little problem we have is this week is Derby Week. It's like our fair, our rendezvous, and he said for me to put this pitch in, and everybody's going to get a hat. So I'm going to do it. They're having the great steamboat race today, the Pegasus Parade, and also the marathons, and virtually everybody that I wanted to call in today is either on a float, at the parade, or involved in some way at the equivalent of for a rendezvous or at, like in Louisiana and those activities. So let me get to the numbers. They shouldn't last more than 4 minutes, and hopefully this will be helpful. Basically, from what I could tell yesterday, there seemed to be some confusion about costs of startup, of number of individuals in it, and then how you're going to hook them into job training or positions. I can give you some detail on Kentucky. They have basically 1.3 million people on Medicaid. About 350 would be eligible for their program. The significant difference I could see in what they're proposing or what we are is they do propose a slight sliding fee scale from $1 to $35 as a premium treating Medicaid expansions as if it was insurance. I don't think we've included that. Their numbers are, and I don't know if this is proportional to Alaska. I didn't hear this yesterday. But about 42% of individuals on Medicaid in Kentucky work. About 18% work of the eligible population. About 18% work part-time. About 12% were exempt because they're caring for a family. 6% were in school. But basically, they homed in on the 7 to 10% of the able-bodied who would seem what could work if they had an opportunity to do so. The Governor Blevins and that administration is basically following the process that was set up by President Clinton and his Welfare to Work programs, which were very successful. And basically right now we have Arizona, Arkansas, Indiana, Kansas, Maine, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Utah, Wisconsin that are in one stage or another of going towards these programs. My phone's going off here. There we go. So anyway, that gives you the crux of the matter there. Their main emphasis is what you're discussing right now. They felt that idleness and creating an underclass that's basically living off the public domain isn't healthy for the individual or the economy or the people around them. And they felt that the main emphasis was to get them back into the workforce and making this part of it. Now, the numbers I heard yesterday were pretty big, i.e. in cost. They seem to follow the Clinton plan, which was welfare agencies would find those that would be needed to be in the program, then start the process with their labor department or whatever department that handles that, and then would then treat it as if, you know, they were newly unemployed and start that process. They did have to do some adjustments in their computer system to get prepared to be able to find those individuals, to forward those individuals, and then receive back reports as to their progress or lack of progress. But it would seem to me, in my discussions this morning at 5 o'clock when I was on the line with their Health and Human Services Department, that if you follow the Clinton model of welfare reform bill from 96, that it's not that much touchy-feel. And I know Kentucky and I'm sure Arkansas, from my information, will be glad to assist, help, and meet by Skype or by phone conference to help smooth out the bumps and to help us contain costs and to move the process along. They do anticipate reductions either through employment, income, or dropping out of the program, mainly employment, to reduce their enrollment in Medicaid by 95,000 over 5 years, which in that state would be close to $2 billion of savings over the same 5 years. I got that number from Bloomberg Economics and also from the department in doing their budget analysis for their bill. But they'll be glad to talk to you. I am going to forward to the staff that contacted me, that I contacted yesterday and then called me back with email, phone numbers, and information of the individuals in Kentucky that are actually planning it, that are actually doing it. Sometimes you don't necessarily need a filter. You need to talk to the people that are actually doing it and being successful at it. And I guess my last sentence in all this is, as a young man, I grew up in the coal camps of Eastern Kentucky and southwestern West Virginia. A dependent society, a dependent community is not a healthy one. This should be not only to help over 5 years constrain costs, especially of Medicaid expansion, but more important, to bring values and to get people back into the work. And they are even having some people, enrollees, who are not eligible because of their status, asking if they can be to get these employment services. So it's not all doom and gloom. I think you can contain the costs much better, and especially on staffing, especially when you're not having to reinvent the wheel and you can talk to two or three states that are about 6 months to a year ahead of you to help you get there. So basically, that's 5 minutes and 15 seconds. And I'm sorry I wasn't rigidly prepared, but this kind of all detonated last night and this early this morning. But I will send my information and my contacts in Kentucky and adamantly ask them to please assist and to give you all their expertise that they have on this program. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Morgan, for your testimony. People are taking notes, especially the Department staff of Labor and HESS. I'm sure you'll be getting contacted as they move forward with this project. And I did hear you say, but I want to put it on the record, if you could please send the committee to Chair McKinnon's office your written testimony so it can be distributed. You had some good information. Thank you for your testimony, and we appreciate it.
You're very much welcome, and I'll help as much as I can, including getting out of your way. Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, let's see. Where am I at? Any other questions at this time? I would like to do a little follow-up and do a fiscal note review, Senator Machicki. And Senator Olson, did you have a question, sir?
Sorry, sir. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
Just a sort of a simple question. We've all heard stories of folks that choose to stay on welfare because going to work doesn't earn them that much more money. Is there a level that we think that an average income that people need to receive to really encourage them to move off welfare? Is this something you can quantify at all?
No.
Dan Robinson, Senator Stevens, through the chair, there is data on duration of unemployment, which is kind of tangentially related to what you're talking about. There wouldn't be an income level, and it would be different for every program depending on the thresholds. We're most familiar with unemployment insurance, so we've got kind of the ability to look at their pre and post and those kinds of things. But there wouldn't be a simple answer to that question.
I understand that. Pretty difficult to quantify. No, thank you, sir.
Okay, seeing no other questions, I just would wrap up with a few comments for myself, and if there's no more, could have Senator Machicki cover the fiscal notes and then fiscal notes. Yes. Just for committee members, we've been here going on 50 minutes this morning, and we've all noticed the great dialogue going back and forth from the committee members to the Department of Labor, RNA and the job training side, ETA. And that's worthy for bringing these folks back next year at another committee for a good 2-hour conversation, because there's such a good story to tell down there at that department, and that we never hear as lawmakers. I do, because I've had an advantage. We've worked there for 6 years. But just on TANF alone, TANF and the chiefs working closely with the Department of Labor in my tenure there actually dropped their TANF enrollment numbers by working through the job training programs in that partnership with a regional nonprofit Native corporation. And so that's just one. And so I won't say any more other than we are fortunate to have the best research and analysis department of any state in the union. Those have got good people. They've got good data. Dan talked about how he didn't say it like I said it, but I'm going to say it. How we've pushed back on big labor, as we call it in Washington, D.C., because we are a one-off here when it comes to changing how you account for employment and changing work assignments for employees. And we push back all the time because Alaska just doesn't fit in big labor's box on how we count employment in Alaska, amongst other things. So I'll just leave that at that. And lastly, by having these two agencies here together, and they're not siloed, they do work together, we're going to get a better product here going forward with 193. So, Senator McChicky, would you cover the fiscal note for us there, that review on your blue sheet, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 193. On the version before us, the committee's intent is to edit the fiscal notes to reflect the cost for getting the waiver application completed only, with an indeterminate cost to be provided for out years. The current out years estimates are based on assumptions from national actuarial studies applied to 2017 Alaska data. The committee would like the Department of Health and Social Services to work with the Department of Labor to determine if existing programs can meet some of the federal requirements. Therefore, we'd like Department of Health and Social Services to provide the committee with the hard costs of doing the 1115 waiver application process in a revised fiscal note, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any comments from committee members? Senator McChicky, I'd entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 193, version 30-LS1349-J from committee with forthcoming fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the committee packet. Okay, we're back on the record. A couple of things before we adjourn here. We will be drafting a letter of intent. There might be a draft copy in your package now, but it will be forthcoming. It is the intent of the Alaska State Legislature that the Department of Health and Social Services work with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to complete a needs-based analysis on workforce development and employability of the target population outlined in fiscal notes for Senate Bill 193. The goal of this analysis is to further refine cost estimates associated with this legislation and to help promote successful outcomes. With that being said, we did postpone HB 135 and 346 till this afternoon schedule, and that schedule will be announced. Just stay tuned to your staff, chiefs of staff, to keep you appraised of the next meeting this afternoon. I don't have a time yet, and we will adjourn at 10:25. Thanks, everyone. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday afternoon, March 2nd, 2018. The time is 2:04 p.m. Members present, Co-Chair Hoffman, Majority Leader McChicken.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson, Senator Stevens, Senator Bonilla, good afternoon. Today's agenda, we have HB 135, School Construction Grant Program, HB 346, Dentist Temporary Permit, and last, HB 409, Vehicles, ID Card Registration and License Fees. HB 135 is the first bill before us. Previous actions, we heard the bill on 4/26/2018. We adopted the CES. We took public testimony, all in support. We reviewed the fiscal note, received additional information, and Senator McChicken.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for House Bill 135, version 30-LS0549/Romeo before the committee as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for explanation. Ms. Lucky, could you walk us through the changes, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, staff to Senator McKinnon. As you might recall, the last time the bill was in front of you, there were some committee concerns about having an undefined time of extension and also having the term good cause undefined. So what you'll see in front of you in version R, I'll be following the explanation of changes document, which should have been provided to committee members. There are two changes. The first change is it limits the extension period to 7 years. That is found on page 1, line 12. And there is also a description of what constitutes good cause, and that is found on page 2, lines 1 through 10. And if the committee wishes, I can verbally go through those, but it is an easy read, so it's up to the will of the committee.